This is Vibrant Spaces, a show about placemaking, activating, and connecting city spaces for the communities you serve.
Hello, Vibrant Spaces friends. My name is Tim Souza, your co-host, and I am here with my lovely co-host and amazing placemaker, Emily Craven. Say hello, Em.
Hello.
That's how she greets me every morning. Isn't it wonderful? So we are excited to be back this week with Cheryl Moriente, who is out of West Palm Beach. In last week's episode, we got to explore how West Palm Beach used a Trojan horse of furniture to uncover some unknown previously shared vision for what downtown could be. And this week we are diving into what comes after that. So like you've gone and collected all of these dreams, how do you operationalize them? And so I'm super excited to talk with Cheryl this week as she returns to really walk us through what hard systems work behind the scenes to make this long-term change. And from like a city ownership perspective of how annual placemaking audits happen within this backend structure. We also are super pumped about this episode because I love how it plays with play and precision. I personally love and hate what we can do with artificial intelligence. And so seeing how Cheryl has implemented this mass knowledge amalgamation tool on this work that she has previously done just really emboldens that kind of building of a strategy for her joy-driven placemaking. It just, all of it makes me super excited about our conversation today.
Yeah, so if you haven't listened to the previous episode, we recommend that you listen to that now. Please it is do. A wonderful base foundation for where Cheryl kicks off her talk into the nitty-gritty about the systems that they have built out of this project. But today you'll hear about how West Palm Beach isn't just throwing events or just making art, they're building infrastructure for equality. And that starts with the data, right? And how they analyze that data and what they have done with that data. And so Cheryl's team reviews everything yearly, what worked, who showed up, who didn't. And they don't just experiment, they reflect before they continue to scale, right? And so she's building this ripple effect. So small grants tied to their community identified pillars that allow other dreamers to carry the work forward. And that's really systems level storytelling that we're seeing here. So you're not here to listen to us. You're here to listen to Cheryl. We'll take a step back and let you download all of her wisdom. So if you haven't listened to last week, listen to it now and then come back here for the wonderful downloading of Cheryl's brain into your ears. Welcome back, Cheryl.
Hi, Emily.
Yes. I'm excited. So excited to have you back again. It is a pleasure to be able to pick your brain more than once. You know, those who are watching us on YouTube, we just wear these every day. These are our everyday speaking costumes. We're definitely not here on the same day recording our second episode. Absolutely not. This is not the magic of Hollywood. Look away. But in all seriousness, it's so wonderful to be able to have you for two episodes, to pick your brain for two episodes. I'm so excited. You have such a creative way of working with city and placemaking, and I can't wait to dive into this episode and the other things that you have done.
Mm-hmm. Same here.
So to get us kicked off, I am just super curious that if I was to give you a gigantic billboard with anything on it, no funding required, your dreams, what would you put on it, metaphorically speaking, and what message would you want to leave, I guess, West Palm Beach with, because that's your home?
You know, what's interesting, no matter what project we've done, the big two words that always come back as a must is be kind. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. No matter what you're doing, no matter what we're working on, just be kind. That's what I would tell everybody. Because once you have that, it's like you have everything, you know, then all things roll through, happiness and just, you know, being able to do things easily as well.
Yeah, I love, that's beautiful. I love that. just simple. Would you end it with a period? Would it visually have any art on it? I mean, I'm asking one of the most creative people I get to speak to. So what would it have anything else other than be kind, or would it look like Got Milk? And then
that's it would look like Got Milk. It's like, okay. just be kind. I'll tell you, it's the way we're going. I think that's going to be our antidote to be able to fix our world. Mm. Like, that's like the first step to just like starting to bring people together and do things for the future in a better way.
Yeah, and you know, it's definitely, I can definitely see that as your mantra, because you talk a lot about, you know, just going and putting those pins on the map, right? Doing the little placemaking pieces that get everybody going, getting everybody thinking, that lift other people in the community up. You have this way of being able to demonstrate things in a kind way, even if it is about something that is a community resistance or like a city resistance, right? And so you talk a lot about encountering resistance, whether it's in like government systems or community skepticism. There was one story that you told us actually about how you were crossing the street with your dad. I would love to kind of dive into that moment and what that provoked, because I think that is a very epitome of the way that you use kindness to approach these kind of issues.
And as you answer it, I would encourage you to answer it without holding any punches. Give us the raw.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a problem with that. So, you know, my dad, he used to be on a wheelchair. Unfortunately, he passed away during COVID. But he had a disease that it was a type of cerebral palsy that took away or deteriorated him slowly, and it took away his motor skills. So towards his end of life, he was on a wheelchair. And I remember I learned a lot by, you know, taking him outside and being with him out anywhere, where it's like finding a restaurant that, you know, it's not all high tops. Like, I once encountered that. I was like, I can't believe they haven't thought of putting a table here, you know, for people in a wheelchair. Or crossing a street, there's one busy intersection to get through on Main Street where the timing signal doesn't have enough time for me to roll him all the way through. And so I remember this made me so upset. And I was like, I'm going to do something about this. I'm not going to, like, somebody can correct those timings on the signal for crossing and just make him a little bit longer, give him 10 extra seconds, and then we would make it through instead of like trying to run through that place. And so I remember I started writing to the county engineer and different people, like, can you please make this change? And I explained why, and I never got a reply. And then I keep pounding and calling and nothing would happen. And at some point in, I think it was like 2016 or 2015, I had this incredible opportunity to run something called the Office of the Public Life. And it was an office without walls. And we were just like, let's fix things by doing little demonstration projects, kind of like little parking day here and there or things like that. And so we brainstormed different activities. And one of them, coming back to this like signal, that timing signal that was driving me nuts and not getting any response back, decided to get a group of dancers to dance in the intersections and kind of freeze in time whenever the little red man would come up on the box, so that it would demonstrate how many seconds you have to cross the street. And so we recorded all this in video, and we also called the news as if we're doing this like awesome cultural intervention at noon during lunchtime. And so when the news came out, you know, that gives us the chance to then deliver the real information, that we're kind of like in a creative way protesting the fact that, you know, this is a simple fix that is done electronically from an engineer perspective, and that we wanted this to change. And so what was interesting is when that hit the news, it obviously then piqued the interest of the engineers. And they did change the signal timing about a week later. It now works great. It actually does the correct timing for that specific place. And they wrote a kind of like a little article in the newspaper that week about their concern about pedestrians. And so in a way, it's like, you know, it was a way to like shame them in a creative way into doing what we needed to do right for the community. So, you know, it's kind of like fixing problems with grace. And so it worked. And that was one of our ammos for many other projects to come. But it was a very interesting time to do that kind of experimentation.
You know, it's interesting to me because you went from, like, you didn't bring blame up at all in that process, right? You highlighted a problem. And I feel like even the way you describe the situation is very eloquently done. It's like, blame isn't even in that conversation. No. You're like, didn't get a response. There's this problem. We're facing a few different problems. I'm going to do something different. And so I think the way in which you approach that, audience take note. Cheryl's brain goes around the problem and looks at it from the other side and says, how can I support these people to lower their drawbridge rather than trying to get the drawbridge to lower by just screaming at it? And right. I think that is a fascinating methodology of how you have like approached change in the city. So thank you very much for sharing that.
And I think that it's also a little bit of an invisible hand approach as well, mm-hmm. right? Like I'm sure that engineer probably got like public.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That. With the article, and it's also like, keep thinking about how we're telling the story. That's the biggest deal. Like, you know, we let the news know like this event was happening, this quirky, weird thing was happening at lunch. Come out and look at the dancers, and then using media as a way to tell the story of what we need. You know, that's a big, powerful tool. The media is always your friend. Like all these years, the media has been our friend to tell everything, to then make action happen. And they used it too. You know, when they did the fix, they told the story in the newspaper and said, look what we have done for the good of the people. And so there's many ways of kind of like twisting the arm into action. But yes, it's very important, you know, even if anybody else got the credit, who cares? Like, it happened and it got done. And so in that way, yeah, we do work as an invisible hand when that happens.
Yeah, and I think that credit piece is huge because I feel like we're trained, especially as Americans, to be like, take credit, build your legacy, do these pieces. Every notch in that belt is something that you can show off at some point, right? And I think your approach of, I think harkening back to our last episode, talking about community champions, you identified that you could use the news as a community champion. You could use the media to mm-hmm. get your message out there in front of the people with the right amount of authority to cause that change. And I think that strategic thinking and your ability to identify and use something like the news, which we all have in our current environment, all kinds of thoughts and feelings about all these different news stations. But you said, you know what? No, they're a champion for the community first and foremost, and I'm going to put them in this position of power so that the change can happen. I think that really does invisible hand wise kind of echo your strategic thinking.
And to acknowledge that, like, it will be a little uncomfortable because when those ballerinas would have frozen in the intersection,
oh yeah,
traffic wouldn't mm-hmm. have been able to go, and so you would have had angry drivers did. And. So it's not going to be necessarily a comfortable experience, but I think that using the comedy of it, of the ballerinas, there is a wonderful program actually in La Paz in Bolivia. They were having a lot of issues with fatalities of pedestrians because people would run red lights, they would run into pedestrians at zebra crossings. And so what they did was they started this program where people dressed up as zebras mm-hmm. and they would stand at the zebra crossings during peak hour traffic, and the zebras would like dramatically make their way across the zebra crossing when the lights would go, and they'd like drape themselves over cars and like faked, and so they would entertain the drivers, and so the drivers would stop, break out of their mentality. Yes. And it dramatically lowered the amount of fatalities and pedestrians yeah. who were hit from these people dressing up as zebras dancing in the street to be like, hey, no, chill out, calm down. Like it was beautiful and delightful. And so, sure, it's uncomfortable, but at the same time, there is the whimsy that comes into play. Mm-hmm.
No, and I think it's like, let's say it's educational in two directions, right? It's even if they're showing any resistance, when you're doing something funny, there is a little, there's the one or two that will beep the horn, but then there's the others that are like, oh, I gotta take out my camera and video this that's happening in front of me. This is so weird. And so I think it's, I wish there's more education towards drivers to understand that, like, if you're just going, let's say instead of 30 miles per hour, you're hitting 50, like we're 1 mile radius. Our downtown is it's small. It's not really a big distance. Like, you're really not going to gain more than like 0.5 seconds, maybe, to your next location by going faster or cutting or, you know, so this idea of like rushing through, you're really not gaining any distance unless you're driving from here to New York. Then yes, it's long enough distance to cut time. But when it's like a short drive, this doesn't really, your speed doesn't matter. You're still going to be late if you were late from the beginning. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, I wish there was a lot more of this mentality or thoughtfulness of like, let me just take it easy. There's no reason to rush so much to places. Because we're terrible drivers in Florida, by the way. It's like, there's so much problems with roads. It's a big, big discussion.
But I mean, like, roads and things not being walkable, I think that's in the bane of a lot of mm-hmm. placemaking and dividing of communities. And
as a sidebar, I've seen some communities in like Arizona who are marketing to say that the reason that Americans have such a nostalgic feeling around their university or college time is because it's the only time they've ever lived in a walkable community. And so they're nostalgic for the ability to access things via foot without the stress of vehicles. And our cities are just built around vehicles, which is, you know, yeah. Sorry, that's a rabbit hole, but it's a fascinating fact to be like, okay, well, if that's the case, why don't we bring that nostalgia to mm-hmm. a lot of different places? Speaking of nostalgia, the Trojan horse policies, the things that have come out of this project that we got to dive deep into in the last episode. You mentioned that there's criteria that has been informed for every event and program that now you must meet. Can you talk us through what those criteria are, how your team has leveraged what you've learned to build the systems to now execute all of these different projects that we ended our last episode kind of briefly touching on?
So yeah, I think one of the things we learned through the project, it was a bit about process. So before going into the themes and like thinking that there's this checklist that's perfect and we got to like go through, we learned a lot that by doing this RFP the way we wrote it, it brought an outside idea in and it worked hand in hand with us to build it together. And so based on that, we actually launched something called the Placemaking Mini Grants, which is like, yes, making people's dreams real right now with them, building them. Like, that was the next step from just collecting dreams and us making them real for the others. You know, it was a little bit of more like we learned from the process that it's not just coming from the people and for them, but let's build it with them. Like, those are the three, you know, from, for, and with. That always has to be present.
So what does a mini grant look like? Can you give me a fun example of what that has turned into, or maybe what community members have brought to you and then how you've executed that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So we had, this year we had four winners that they just concluded in February was the last one. So we had an art vending machine. Like, somebody had this dream that they wanted to buy a vending machine and have local art in it. And so what it created was like a small, tiny museum or gallery where you can buy affordable art from local sources and learn more from them. So that was very popular, still going around because it actually turned into that person's business. She now has three machines.
It turns into a business, yes!
Yes. So, and this is a $5,000 grant that is now evolved into like somebody's, you know, livelihood. Deal.
You're keeping money in the community by sponsoring someone's idea to become a business for $5,000 as a city revenue.
That's one output that can come out of the Placemaking Mini Grants. Yes.
That is freaking phenomenal. Take note, humans. Take note. What's another one? I'm go again.
So a second one that we thought was very interesting is that we had never celebrated the Chinese Lunar New Year. So this person, again, these grants are like, you just do 1 minute pitch. So you can be anybody. You can be a student. You can be, you don't have to be well-versed about like doing a full blown grant proposal. You know, it's like, I have an idea. Here's my video for 1 minute. And then there's a group of us that sit down as a selection committee, go through all the videos. And with that dream checklist feeling, you know, like environmental, multi-generational, is it addressing the waterfront? Is it addressing positive outcomes? Is it accessible? Is it connecting community? So, you know, like those are like the, let's say the dream themes. We were using that to help us decide which are the winners, because we can't, again, have all the entries win. We don't have enough money. So there are four winners. One was that vending machine. The second one that I thought was fabulous was that lantern. It's called the Lantern Festival. So we learned a lot from her that Chinese Lunar New Year is not just like that day. It's 15 days of celebration. So when the Lunar New Year happens, 15 days later, they have lanterns everywhere that they put together with the community. So we build 200 lanterns in a 6-month period of time through these outdoor art workshops, and then took over Citizen Garden with a whole program with Chinese cultural programming, food, music, you name it, it was happening. And so from there, that community, which has never been represented before in downtown, came back and were like, we want to do now Buddha's birthday. We now want to do this. And so we have new members that through this grant are showing up to do more programs with us naturally. So, you know, that's a very interesting way to empower groups of people that we didn't know existed in our community.
I just want to put like a big shout out for you doing the 1 minute video piece. So like one of the most transformative projects that I was ever a part of in a creative community was that the city of Brisbane started this like Lord Mayor's Innovation Award. And so it was a very significant award. It was a $25,000 award to an innovative idea. And so it was like a one-page application form. And then what you would do is they would invite all of these creators to come to like a one-day symposium. And they did a bunch of other things during this symposium. But one of those was that all of the people who were shortlisted would then pitch to a room full of creators. And this was everyone from like fashion designers to musicians to knitters to like the whole gamut of creative. And that was actually how Story City ended up getting its start, because we got shortlisted as one of those things. We each had 2 minutes on stage to pitch our innovative idea, and then they gave everybody voting papers and they all voted. And then at the end of that session, we knew who had gotten that funding. And that was how we ended up starting. We were like the inaugural people that got that, but they continued to do that every year. And they didn't morph. And so they went from doing live pitches, which they found that like people got a little bit too frenetic about doing live pitches. And so they went to doing like 1 minute videos. And so they would still bring everybody into this auditorium. They would allow everyone in the creative community who had gotten tickets, which were free, to come into this auditorium. They all got to vote on it, right?
Yeah.
All of these shortlisted people, and taking that, not only the community ideas, but allowing people to express them, not having to do it in written form. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of people that you discount because you make this insanely long form, and they can't go off work to do the effort to put this form together to pitch their idea. Just giving them 1 minute video was just like.
It's a big deal. It opens, it lowers the barrier of entry immediately. So, I mean, we saw it with the Lantern Festival, where it was like English was not her first language. And so it was would have been very difficult to write down a 10-page proposal, you know, with all the normal things. And, you know, and what was interesting is once we shortlisted them, then where we came and kicked in besides the money is we gave technical assistance. And so we were the ones pulling the permits, the insurance. We were the ones like getting the tables and chairs, the amplifier. So you don't have to use the money to buy that stuff.
Wonderful.
Because we already own it. or do it on a regular basis, but you come and bring in the people and the things that are going to make this happen. And so that is, again, that same model of Troy and Rocking Horse, how we built that contract with that artist. We're using it at the smaller scale where it's like community person and us. And then how do we work together, like really chained together? And it's not, again, it's not about like, here's 5,000, see you when the project is done, you know, like, give me a report when you're finished. Like, that's what we do when we have to do grants. And so I was like, how in the heck of a world where, you know, the community is the expert at knowing what we need, but not necessarily a technical expert at how to pull a permit for an event. And so that's where we want to, you know, bridge that gap by doing that part of the job and then empowering them to do their ideas in real time.
I think to me, this sounds like a great example of like how you set up expectations within the community, right? Like doing a massive project like the Trojan Horse has given you obviously street cred with your community, but like it's obviously shifted the way that departments and partners approach you as well, right? So they're now coming with expectations. Right, they're coming in being like, great, how are you incorporating us, and also how does this reflect our dreams, and like that's huge, like it's amazing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the departments, like, so because we've done so many weird things already, they're like, what's next? I mean, I'm not kidding, I just had a meeting with like the events department at some point this past few months, and it's been, yeah, it's like they know that come August, I'm going to show up with a stack of permits. And it's like, here's our fiscal year of things that are coming. But they're getting used to it. You know, it took a while, but they're there now. And they do enjoy seeing us work the spaces, because it's turning around also the public spaces into very usable, and people are now lingering there. Again, it's this whole thing of when some of these public spaces were not designed to hold programming at all. Example is like there's no electricity on one of them. And so we have a partnership with the parking garage that's right butting up against it, so that we can pull energy from them, cable it over, and then put our musician to play with it, or electrify a vendor or whatever is going on. And so it's quite interesting when we're like finding those solutions with everybody that's around you, helping you make things happen.
It doesn't sound like there's too much that's off the table for you, Cheryl, when it comes to getting this work done. And I freaking love that.
I mean, yeah. Honestly, I think anybody, you know, let's put it this way, like all I can tell anybody who wants to do this, like, mm-hmm. just don't be afraid to ask anything, like ever. You know, like don't start with this can't be done. That's one, the first thing that has to come out of our language is like, that's impossible, or that can't happen. Like, I hate it when people say, you can't solve homelessness. It's like, let's just take that first sentence out of our language, and then start dealing with the project or the problem. Because if you start with a negative, you're not going to ever get it done. It's, yeah. you're killing your own energy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like and I think that that's what makes a good experimenter. Mm-hmm. Right. As Tim said, you are a public realm scientist, and those experiments, and I think that you, and here's the thing, like the willingness to allow for these odd ideas that may seem impossible but can come through, which then generate other ideas from a community that previously hadn't realized they could be heard, and are now bringing like Buddha's birthday and those sorts of things into that mix. That's where you start. But then also as part of experimentation, you have to evaluate,
yes.
right? And so how do you look at what continues forward so that you have room for the new ideas that come in from the community, but then you also have that consistent feeling of yearly celebration And so how do you determine what continues to move on and then what potentially you let it be a wonderful experiment and then it changes into something else?
So, you know, we're always data collecting. We're always videoing and also taking pictures of everything, plus anecdotal information from the actual whatever's happening on the ground level. And so that's kind of the formula. And when we're collecting data, we're not just collecting like RSVPs versus actual people that showed up. Because we use Eventbrite for that. Even though it's free to the public, we have them like register. And when there's super open events, what we do is like, because that's really hard to gauge like who, you know, they're just walking in. So we have this little trick where we have a QR code and we have you register. So you get a ticket to get a free tasting of whatever our food is being offered. So everybody wants to taste the food. Everybody wants to get some tea. Everybody wants to get like a drink, or so they are forced to register, you know, and then those who walk through, they walk through, it's fine. We still have people counting on the hour to see how many stationary people were on a park or plaza on the hour. So all those data points give us like volume of people in public space. The other side of the data collection that's internal, external, is we survey with something I call lessons learned. And so it kind of asks you like, when did you go to this program? What was your capacity, like staff, a vendor, or if you were a person that were just coming to be part of the project, you know, as a spectator. And then there's several projects, you know, questions about like, if you're staff, then it triggers like, what did you do? What did you wish you could have done better? What didn't work? So we can like fix our logistics. With vendors, we do the same. So we understand like, did we miss something that we didn't think of, that maybe you need two amplifiers instead of one, or whatever those nuances are that we can't, you know, catch every day. And for the participants, we ask about like, how they, you know, they feel more about like emotion. How do they, you know, did they meet other people in terms of sociability? Do they want more of this? So it's a little bit more like on the emotional level to understand like, did they enjoy it, or do they want more? Do they want something else? And that kind of hits the now and the future aspects of that question. And so when I gather all that surveying, I'm the one who sits with the Excel sheets and again, reanalyze everything so that when I'm looking at both the map with the team, we'll sit and do this big meeting with like, here's all the recurring programs. Here's everything that we data collected. And we can see like which ones had an increase in audience, or maybe it decreased, or it stayed flat. You know, so these are all the things we're looking at in terms of attendance. And then we really analyze the making it better and want, and what are the wants in the internal part. And we choose for the future. What's the next couple of programs that are going to roll out? And so this is this works really well internally for the team. But even on the beginning aspects of like the alleyway project, for example, we counted how many people were there on the hour, where they conglomerated and why. And when we presented the activation project to City Hall right after, that data was what put in the books for them to do alleyways as a capital improvement project throughout all of downtown West Palm Beach. So it's, these are the pieces that you need to justify to the city, like why we should do more, or why we should do, I don't know, something else that hasn't happened yet.
So it sounds to me like you're not just focused on, like, we talk a lot about the qualitative data, like all of the different opinions and dreams and pieces that you've collected from the community, but you're also matching that with quantitative data. Like, here's the event, here's the number, here are the people, this is, we know that they come from these communities. Like, you can take that data and then you leverage it for mm-hmm. change, which I think really goes back to your, you know, don't say it can't, don't say it's not going to happen. Like, just prove out, do the work. And it's it, your statement that reminded me of, like, if you do, audience, say I can't, one of the things that I was raised with is add the word yet, because sometimes it slips out, but you got to throw the word yet on the end of it, right? And so adding that word yet, I feel like is what you do, Cheryl, as you, if you've done these pieces, you're like, here's that we have our experiment. We lay this out. We're going to, we believe it's possible. It'll happen, just maybe not yet, but we'll make it happen via this data. And one of the things that I think was super interesting that you did as far as data-driven decisions and experimentation was what happened as your COVID response for the downtown. You, from what you shared with us, you said you were able to save dozens of businesses throughout that process. How did you design something so effective on the budget that you had in the era that was lockdown and COVID?
Yeah, this was, I mean, honestly, this was like, I feel like I'm still having PTSD and recovery from this project, because while everybody was home playing with their children and taking care of them, which obviously was needed because children weren't going to school, and that's, I can't even imagine what that could have been like. I was like grinding all this out and trying to make it happen. So I remember it so vividly. Like, the city closed March 13th. It like, that was it. Like, you're closed. You can't, everything's shut down. Cause we don't know what we were dealing with. And before the shutdown, I was already working on this experiment that didn't become real, but now it doesn't even matter, cause it was useful for this. We were doing we're trying to get the city to adopt something called temporary use permitting. So every time I was permitting a program, I need to either pull a special events permit, or I have to do like an interlocal agreement to use the land, depending on who owns it. And it's very complex. Some of it is like leasing land. Some of it is like borrowing it for a moment, but there was no mechanism to temporarily use vacant land or open public space to do something that's not building an actual building. And so when you're wanting to do it, like, let's say a pop-up that lasts 6 months, you got to go in, take it out, and then come back, put it in, take it out. And I wanted to find a way to like put it in for, you know, 3, 6 months or 9 months before a building gets built without having to do infrastructure and bathrooms and parking limits and all the things that we have to do for a regular building. So we started that experiment. COVID hit and we had the report. And I remember, like, I ran back into City Hall, like, let's use this for an emergency order, please. And so the planning department wrote an emergency order, and we went back and forth on it to allow for doing different configurations on streets to do a pop-up of dining outside. Like, that all tables and chairs would be 6 feet apart. We would need umbrellas because the sun here is incredible. We need tents if it's a parklet, like things like that. And so I ended up, the ordinance passed, and then we kind of let all our businesses know, like, this was available in case they wanted to reopen. And obviously some were like, this is weird, but okay, I'll go in. I need to survive. So we had a handful at first. So in a matter of 6 months, we had popped open 10 city blocks, 48 businesses at the ground floor level. And the way we actually got all those tables and chairs and things was by paying the company that actually does our event planning, which was also suffering. That industry didn't have anything to do with all, they weren't able to rent things out for months. And so it saved all those different businesses together. It was about $100,000 spent in those 6 months. And we were able to do a full road closure, a alleyway closure, parklets all over the place, sidewalk cafe seating all over the place. And it was kind of interesting, like every time it was all red umbrellas everywhere. So I always called it the power of the umbrella, because when it was open, you knew you could go there and it was like the business was open, because there was so much no understanding of like what was really happening, or can I go to that place, or can I take out food? And online, we did an online concert where we did our own to, again, save the music industry at the same time. So, because this is all that makes that nightlife work in downtown. And so it's like you have the musician, you have the event planners, and you have the businesses all like in chiming into this project. And in our online music, which became very popular really quickly, I mean, all cities were doing it, but we would interject our own advertisement in between the different musicians. And we're like, hey, you can get, you know, some burritos and tacos at so-and-so's place, which is open thanks to dining on the spot. You know, and then the musician would go on. And then in the next ad, it would be like just us literally saying, and now the pizzeria blah is like, you can order and take out, et cetera. So what was interesting about this is that it became like a 3-year process of changing ordinances. And today we have, honestly, the most progressive parklet ordinance in place, thanks to this experiment. Our first official parklets are already down. I have a grant program for that to happen permanently. And the sidewalk cafe seating as well got also rethought and reworked through. And so it's really interesting to see how I knew a lot of cities were struggling afterwards, like taking the dining outside away. But we were able to actually shift the tide and keep it and expand on it, honestly. So I think we only lost like 4 businesses in that time, which is it's insane number.
That is epic. That is so epic. Only lose 4 businesses for $100,000. And not only like street level businesses, the people who were renting all of the equipment, like all of that, like all of those sorts of things. Like that is an epic economic impact.
Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, those 4 businesses, were they, why did they shut down? Do you have the data? You're data driven, so you got to know.
Yeah. Well, why. I know like one of them, I know it was a big brewery space. And I remember there was a couple of things going on in the real estate world that was so, it wasn't the best thing that happened. But like, I think there were people that were like given time to not pay rent right away because they were shut down. But then there was, you had to back pay it later. And so when the year came through, it was one of those things where like they couldn't afford to repay the 3 or 4 months of rent that was, you know, not forgiven, but delayed. So it was sort of a numbers problem with, you know, especially with the ones that were a little bit bigger, you know, that the smaller shops, what was interesting is like, they really survived because they could not handle people inside at 6-foot distances. They're just, it would have been like, maybe there's a tiny little, place called, I remember Blind Monkey, they wrote us this incredible email where he said, my indoor space by law could maybe sit like 4 people because of how it's designed. And having the parklet outside that spanned over, I think it was like 3 or 4 parking spots, he was able to have the same amount of people are inside outside, and he survived. And he actually moved into a bigger space afterwards. So not only did they survive, he grew out of that space. I mean, that's like, I couldn't believe what happened, you know, for him. Like, that was just amazing. So he really wrote a very heartfelt email. Like, if it wasn't for this, I would have to shut down. Because by law, I couldn't have, and you couldn't really take out from this, like, it was like a wine bar and charcuterie bar. So, like, you can't really go for that to take out. You know, it's a little different.
I wonder, out of that, what have you what about that strategy still works now, 3 years later, right? Like, obviously that was a pandemic, things were weird, we all have post-traumatic stress. What works now that you've kind of taken forward? Obviously the ordinance continues, the parklets are now growing into their own permanent program.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the parklets is the biggest deal. We had already, so the parklet study started way before pandemic. Like, so back in like 2016, I ran this program called Street Balconies because parklets were not allowed. So I was like, okay, we'll redefine them. We'll call them something else. And I'll pull a right-of-way permit for this parking spot for the next 3 months. And we're going to study and see how they work. And so we plopped some, like, three parklets in downtown. It was successful. But when that went to City Hall, once it went through the engineering department, they were like, oh, we got to, like, chamfer the corner so that cars don't hit it. We need to bring it 2 feet into the parking spot. So now it's like a 5-foot platform. So you can only maybe sit like 4 or 6 people max in these little things. So nobody want to invest in them because it's like, okay, I'm going to invest all this money in a parklet that I'm just going to have 6 seats. This makes no sense. And so when this happened, we used the maximum space and we used it in moratorium for 3 years. And so it really ruled all these ideas of safety into like, this is working. There's not a single incident with a car. Nobody died, you know, nobody was run over. Nobody ran over a parklet. And so today that shifted into like, they could have multiple parkings for the parklets. There can be 50% of the city block as a parklet per block. I mean, that is huge compared to before it was like one parking spot per block. So these big wins came from proof of design. And so at the end of the day, we did our temporary use permitting experiment, but it just happened like because of this. And so I want to say like that's adaptable. I want to say cities should really think about downtowns have a certain scale to them that is not the same scale as a highway or the same scale as suburbia. And so start designing in a way that's for the pedestrian, that's for slowing the cars down. That's how I feel like this taught us all those lessons on adapting to the reality of our scale.
So quick out of that, the gut response that I have that like just bubbles up just because I talk with city people all the time is, how did the public react to less parking availability downtown? Because you're taking the parking spots away to build these spaces. They had all of these assumptions about safety, but what about just access? Because parking and accessibility, access, how did that flesh out in your experiment?
So yeah, funny enough, we're lucky. We redid our streetscape on the main street before COVID kicked in. And actually all of that area became curbless. There's four city blocks that were done that way. And so the first block, all the businesses at the beginning of that project were like, no, I don't want to take the parking away. I need parking. So the customer is right there and come into our space. Then by the time because we did it as a flexible thing. So since it's curbless, it's so easy to pop out. And we had done some pop out like experiments. And so by the time it got to the fourth city block, those businesses did not want parking spaces in front of their space because they knew that these restaurants over here that didn't have the parking space in front of them were making more money because they had more sidewalk. So it's almost like the sidewalk went from being, I think it was like 6 foot to 20. And so a lot of the spaces that have that 20, it's like a natural parklet. And they all talk to each other. So it's like, wait a second, so-and-so is doing more revenue than me. Like, this isn't what I want, my little space in front, you know? So by the time we got to that fourth city block, people were really like, the businesses didn't want parking at all in front of their spaces. So I think the shift just came by doing the streetscape program, not so much from COVID. COVID just really reiterated that we can go a little bit further, you know, in terms of like, we already did the redesign, but we can still take a little bit more. And so it's like, people come first. I mean, at the end of the day, cars can go sleep in the garage all day long, you know what I mean? Like, so it's just changing the habits of park in the garage and walk on over.
And as you say, that flexibility is really important, because here in Canada, obviously, we get a ton of, in Edmonton in particular, get a ton of snow. So like having a parklet be permanent during winter sometimes doesn't make a bunch of sense, right? And that, but that flexibility is really wonderful and helpful, and then allows for other things to happen during winter, like they'll block off an entire road and then they'll put out barrels that have like fires, like wood fires in them and stuff, which is like absolutely delightful. Couldn't necessarily happen in a parklet because, you know, too close to a building, but like it, different things changing, and that flexibility and that ability to pull things in and out is just, yeah, it makes sense.
Absolutely. No, and you're right. I mean, when we're designing these blocks or these city streets, like we have to be thinking of everything that happens through your seasons. Like weather is a big deal for us. Like the more coverage we have, the bigger, you know, the bigger deal for us. I know that for you guys, it's all about like, how do you deal with the cold? Because the summer, again, is, so we're actually the opposite spectrum of like, how do we deal with the heat? And so I think that's where you start seeing, you have to adapt to the place and what it needs.
I mean, you do. And over time, things need to change too, right? It sounds to me like the way that the business has responded to all of that is that you gave them an extra lung. They could expand that lung as they needed to expand their business, or contract it as they needed to like shrink things down and adjust, which, I mean, really speaks to how you're putting people first. And so speaking of the putting people first, things are changing around those, the terminology, things are changing around how governments are getting support and funding around terminology. And I think you've done an amazing job at looking at language as import, specifically when you're looking at funding, when you're looking at speaking to the community, when you're looking at asking the news to cover anything. So can you really talk to us about what how you're approaching this in this DEI funding freeze as the federal government is eking out money back to state and local in a very targeted way. And then can you speak a little bit to that language change of how you're going to continue to achieve the amazing work and results that you have been working on, but maybe shifting the way that you talk about it so that you can get the work done without being caught up in the red tape of language policy change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, this is a reality now. Like we just submitted a grant where we got an email stating, well, you got to resubmit because we can't say DEI anymore. And so I remember having to go right through the whole thing and rewrite it in a sense that it's, we're not saying diversity, equity, inclusion. We're literally saying for all, for everyone, for the community, for the city, for downtown, you know, like using the global word that means all of us as a collective. Because at the end of the day, we are everything. And so I'm like, if that's the game you want to play, then I will say it your way. Give me the money so we can continue doing the work that needs to happen. And so I think that's a type of quiet resistance that can be done. That I do encourage other cities to think through that, you know, yes, it's good. There has to be the people that beat the drum against what's happening, but you also have to sometimes kind of play within the system to change the language from within. And so I feel like that happened like with that parklet thing, you know, like we had to call it something else because parklets weren't allowed. Or if I were to pull a permit, I would have to, you know, checkbox something else that isn't, you know, it's kind of like reading all the municipal code and deciding where is that gap where the law doesn't exist so that we can make it happen. And so that's the story of evolution of cities. I mean, that will continue forever. And the pendulum will swing back to the other way full on. I do believe in that. So,
yeah. And it sounds like what you're saying is like, go back to the intent of the action and then relabel the action, whatever you need to, so you can have the desired effect.
Absolutely. Especially if you are, I mean, in need of this kind of funding. Yes. If you are autonomous, and then I say, fight the fight and call it what it is. Do not stand down.
Using your phrase, blanket,
you know,
just go for it. Love it.
Just do it. No, sorry. That's Nike. But no, it's, you know, language is very important. It's what makes, again, like you guys know, telling stories, language is what connects us to things, and how we express it is what motivates people to do or not do things.
And I think that it's also, language will, particular types of language will make people form an opinion, to push back. And I think that, the benefit of the whimsy that you have brought to a lot of your placemaking, in the same way that there is a benefit to fiction and things being fictional and people having, you know, in sci-fi stories, aliens trying to get along when they're really just talking about us on Earth trying to get along between our different cultures, that whimsy and putting things within a fictional, whimsical context breaks people out of the opinion side of things. And so if people have strong opinions about language, bringing in whimsy, bringing in synonyms that mean the same thing but don't have the political bomb attached to them, you're still achieving the same end. You are bringing people around to being kinder by attaching that whimsy to things. It's annoying that it is sometimes needed, but at the same time, adapting things around and helping people kind of come together, no matter what language you use, is really important.
Speaking of the language changes, right before we hit record, you were telling us about placemaking maybe needing to change, and being someone who covers placemaking via this podcast with Emily on a consistent basis, I'd love to be edumacated. And if you could edumacate me on why placemaking needs to have a different title as we enter into this brave new world, I would love to hear about it.
Absolutely. So, you know, placemaking has always existed. I mean, the term got coined in the 70s by PBS, but in today's world, what I've seen in the last, like, I want to say like 10 years or so, 15 years or so, is that back then when we would say placemaking, it's like, what? How do you do that? What is it? And almost like a skepticism of like, why would urban planners want to try doing that? That's a community thing. That's a kumbaya thing. You know, like it's not city related, et cetera. And in today's world, like I've seen in conferences, in presentations, both local, regional, international, like everyone's using the word now. It's the thing. It's like everyone does placemaking. We're all placemakers. Even if I'm an artist, a developer, and whatever, it doesn't matter. We're all placemakers. And sometimes when that happens, the core of the definition, and I love it because everyone's like, there's no real definition for it. No, it's very mutable, but there's some core qualities to why it's placemaking and why it's not. And so, ooh, I get asked
those really quick. Can you just be like, education. Oof,
so that's like a 1 hour session right there, okay, that you need to take on a webinar.
Can you give me three then?
So basic things, like it needs to include community, period. It is a process, period. You know, it's like you can't say that like it's a one-time thing. It is a process. And I want to say as a third, it's like it has to come from a need in the place. So you have the people of the place, you have the place itself as needing. And what I mean by that is like there's a vacant lot, or there's a building that's empty, or there's a underutilized space, right? So you have like the space component, you have the human community component, and it is a process. Like those three things have to be in it. An event is not that. An event is a one-time scheduled, paid, ticketed thing. Or even if you do it free, you're paying vendors to entertain a group of people one time. But if the event was done with the community, for the community, you know what I mean? Like then it starts shifting into placemaking. And that there's a process to get there, that it wasn't just like one or two people had an idea and it got done, period. So there are differences. And I feel like everybody's using the word now, which is kind of good and bad, because it's good that, you know, it's everywhere up to a certain degree, but in the end, it's losing its power. And so that happened to architects, by the way. Like, you know, at some point, like, I know I'm going on a tangent here, but like, architects forever were protecting that word by being a licensed architect. You can call yourself an architect. If you're not licensed, you couldn't. But then the IT groups adopted that word as an architect of information. And then the word just became an architect of this, an architect of that. And like, it lost its power for that group in a way. Anyway, digressing. But to me, I feel like the next step is to truly get into what's called public sphere making. And public sphere is a very, very old concept that is based on democracy. It's based on including everyone in democracy, and that there's a space for dialogue, and that's it's an open and free dialogue. And this dialogue influences political action. And so it is the basis of, in a way, what to me is the true placemaking process. And so it's not losing, I guess, maybe starting to re-educate people about that arena and understanding how that's going to help push forward the future of placemaking. And, you know, within placemaking, there's many, many different types of things. Like, some people do tactical urbanism, guerrilla art. I do urban acupuncture. That's my thing. I also do something called archaeology of local knowledge. So it's like tapping into the experiences of and memories of a place to like get those dreams out of them and then show that identity back at them. And so there's so many types of placemaking. So you know, it's like we can still play with those tools, but I feel like the bigger picture at the end of the day is, again, how to do like a true process of democracy through action.
And I love that. And before you were listing, you had a list of co's. I called them the co-co's on my little notes here. Can you talk to us about the co-co's and what that would look like tangibly, everything you just proposed?
What do you mean by co-co's? Like
you, that? You said co, it was like co-creating and co-this, yes, and co-that, the co-co's.
I love that. I'm going to steal that from you.
It's what I wrote on my notes.
We're going to co-coin this right now. So like, it's, yeah, collaboration, doing everything, like co-budgeting, co-designing, everything that's participatory, you know, in the sense of the, so if we're designing, we do it with the process of doing it with the community. If we're doing the budgeting, do it with the community. That's where like the placemaking mini grant, honestly, it's a co-budgeting exercise or a participatory budgeting exercise where here's this like a money that comes, you know, from taxes. And we say, we are letting you guys decide in this small amount or a grant what we're going to put this money into. And that is kind of like the way we got to get into doing cities better. Because everybody counts. And the best way or the best cities are the ones where everybody's involved and everybody's free to just express themselves publicly.
Where the co-co's have free reign.
Yes. That's good governance, by the way, like to do all those collaborative things.
100%. I have loved the second conversation, and I was like, surely we'll be able to do the second conversation much more compressed. We've gone over the big project. Like, no. I could not stop listening, and it was an absolute delight to have you here for a second episode. It was just learn so much about reframing, about including everyone, about data not being scary, about how you get everyone working towards the same goals. And again, I'd like to reiterate to people, you know, these horses are just kind of hanging out now. I mean, you could probably borrow 2, you could probably borrow 4, you could probably borrow 8. I'm sure that Cheryl would be amenable to helping you kind of go forth on that path through your community. But I just wanted to say a big thank you, Cheryl, for all of your knowledge, for all of your generosity, for all of your plain speaking, all of your kindness. I like to close out our episodes with our guests by asking them a question that is dear to my heart, because I'm a very strong reader. It's one of the main things that I love. I read like 80 books a year. And so I want to know, what is the book or the books you have given most as a gift, and why?
That is a tough one.
The ones that have been most influential on you. I'm happy.
Yeah, that.
Or just pull one off the shelf. We're flexible
here. Let me just like turn around and start pulling things down. I have to say, so it's funny. I don't like reading fiction. I don't know why. I rather watch movies. And so I'm actually going to give you the most influential movie that has such incredible theoretical background, because I read a lot of theory. So I read a lot of like Frankfurt School, like thought leaders from back in the day. I'm really into like all the way out to the Greeks and the Romans. Like I'm so into all that old stuff. And then obviously there's modern things that are amazing as well. Sartre, Nietzsche, I mean, you name him. But so that's where my brain's always reading that kind of heavy stuff about the meta theory of the theories. But there's this movie called Metropolis by Fritz Lang. It's a black and white movie. It's very long and silent, but it shows a city, and it shows that the city only is working because what they call the hands are the people that are always working like nonstop. And there's this like elite that lives above in the highest, tallest building that don't see any of the inner workings of a city. And within this like garden of beauty and money and nonchalantness, there's this woman, Maria, who connects what we call the head of the city with the hands of the city. She's the heart. And so they make a mechanical woman out of her to like throw off the people that are, you know, keeping the city going and infect them with bad things. And so it's kind of a very interesting story about cities and how, you know, I guess in the end, what he was saying is like, when you have heart, that's what connects the mind with the hands. And that's the most important thing for the city to be built correctly. And so it's a beautiful, I mean, for me, again, not everybody can take silence for 2.5 hours, but to me, it's just such a fascinating story that was being told back then in black and white. And it's still true to this day. It's like the head will never function with the hands unless there's a heart that tells it how to do it. So I guess we're the hearts, and that's what I love about that. That's my recommendation. Watch
Metropolis. Beautiful. Beautiful. That is a beautiful way to end this second episode. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here, and hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Tim.
Absolutely. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I'll keep you in touch with you guys, obviously. Like, I've been thinking of teaching more about this. So good. Just stay tuned.
Excellent. You heard it here first, folks. Bye.
I know. She's amazing.
Just point her in a direction. Just point her in a direction, ask a question, and wisdom falls out.
You know, she also is going to fit on my bench of people that I will pull when I become president to sit on that cap. Yeah, she's in charge of a whole region of something. I don't know what yet. Probably
Department of Cities, to people. DC.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the way Cheryl that blends like delight and accountability is like extraordinary. Like she makes resistance harder by making joy contagious. Like ultimate power move right there.
Yeah. Speaking of power moves, she's truly an expert in soft power, I think.
What do you mean by that?
Soft power versus hard power. So soft power, you know, we would refer to it as like leadership skills, probably is a good category, something of that would fit underneath soft power. Hard power would be like militaries and bombs. And for our current geopolitical environment that we're in right now, someone who exhibits the kind of humility in soft power approach that Cheryl does, I think is, she stands out because it's not normal. And not only is it not normal in like the placemaking space, but it's like, as far as I was raised in, like I was raised in the Central Valley of California, which is incredibly conservative. And I was raised in like how important your legacy is and how important your credit is. Like if it's your fault, if you get credit for that, et cetera, that is so pervasive in the American culture that I was raised in, that for me to see someone who looks at all of that and just laughs and says, all of your rules are made up. Yeah, you can take the credit. Does it solve the problem? Great. And so like her ability to empower others to take that credit, I find very rare, specifically maybe because of the generous muscle that it uses, that she uses as she does it, but it's the outcomes of things being fixed, but her not having to take credit as the fixer, I think is brilliant and wild. And what really gets her through doors that she normally wouldn't. So as we talked about with like last week and the Trojan horses and furniture, that sidestep government pieces, I think she really shows it here when we talk about the ballerinas that cross the street, right? And as she is resisting power structures that beat male engineers that are not getting back to her, she doesn't get just angry at them and say, oh man, they're getting mad at me because I'm a Latina woman who wants this change. She says, hey, I'm gonna cause the change by getting a bunch of dancing ballerinas to pause in the middle of a street and stop traffic during lunch hour. And then when everybody complains about it, I'm going to celebrate the person in power and allow him to get a op-ed in the newspaper. And then when that's done, you say, great. And then you get to do the next one. Because she didn't stand in the way of the mayor receiving, you know, the accolades for the Trojan horses or the engineers receiving accolades for changing the lights. She just moved on. And I think that kind of humility allows people to own the solution that she led them to, which is incredibly rare. And I can go off on it for hours. I respect it a ton. Because it's not only is it not par of the course, especially in government, but it's also, she sets the kind of example that people look to religious figures to set, and she's just doing it. And I think that is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's something that really has perplexed me about the US culture in general. I think, I come from cultures where like tall poppy syndrome is a thing where like you don't talk yourself up. Right. And so it can be jarring to go to US conferences and like that is the most forward facing kind of thing. And if you are not good at talking yourself up, people lose interest. And so you're right. I think that's kind of like the way to approach it. And I mean, like in terms of tactics, like that's where my admiration of her comes in, right? Is in that, like, you know, she uses the Trojan horse to inform the microgrants that they run, right? So she seeds the community ownership without losing the shared vision, which is this amazing blueprint for like sustainable community storytelling, right? Yeah. But she is, again, very analytical, very like acupuncturist in that approach of like, there's a rigor behind it. There are annual reviews, there are strategic frameworks, there are systems of measurement. It is not a free for all.
Right. It's not all the feelings. There's logic as well, but she recognizes that the people who are logicking also have feelings. And so she addresses the wholeness, both in her placemaking and in the people she's working with. She holistically addresses things. I think that is maybe what you're getting at as far as that sustainability in that space.
I think so. It's that long-term, low-cost, high-impact system.
right? Like that's constantly what we strive to build with Story City. You shouldn't have to make your own, spend $100,000 on making your own app. The infrastructure should already be there so that it is long-term, low-cost, high-impact. And that's what she has built at West Palm Beach.
Yeah, I mean, and you can see, I mean, I'm going to use your $100,000 and invest it differently. You can see how she invested it in during COVID, right? Mm-hmm. Like, hey, our problem is that we have these businesses that are going to shut down because they are not receiving revenue flow. How can we respect people, the business owners, the individuals coming, the fact that we're underneath a global pandemic, and continue to placemake? Because it doesn't matter that, you know, we're underneath a pandemic or we're underneath a different governmental regime, people still need another place to go and a place to be. And they still need to be able to access food, et cetera. So I can't even, like, I would love to know, I know she's metric driven, but she's not metric driven to the end where what that $100,000 investment generated for the city. But I know that if it kept that many businesses open, it's in the millions.
Yeah, only right? only four people shut down.
Well, and they shut down because of bad, you know, leasee agreements. So it had nothing to do with the fact that COVID happened. And the fact that she was able to save that many businesses, transform the way that the city now does the micro parks, what are those called?
The parklets.
Mm-hmm. She transforms the way that the city has done parklets, the way that people think about parklets in the city, and really created FOMO for those businesses that had outdoor seating versus those that didn't, because then now those that didn't saw that more people were willing to go to outdoor seating locations, and it's lasted beyond COVID.
But also she did not treat COVID as a potential once off. She made sure that the policy changes were in place so that if this happens again, as it does in a globally connected world where we have planes going everywhere,
right,
that the policy change is already in there to help them survive and they know how to do it. Whereas I think that a lot of North American cities that we spoke to just went back to like business as usual.
Yeah, but I think that the part of that is that she has such a design discipline around what they're doing with placemaking, right? They're not, and when they're looking at the place, they're not just decorating it. They're not just throwing up a piece of art. They're not just hanging some lights. They're designing a system for people to belong in any environment, including a globally connected one that can spread disease or one that would fall apart because of, you know, other political factors that are going on. And so it's resiliency is what she's built into that system.
It's also like transforming like barriers into collaboration as well, right? Like that this like so clearly connects back to what we heard in Kansas City in season one and even like Baltimore in this season. Like there are a bunch of barriers to collaboration and everything you do should be looking at systematically trying to remove those barriers one by one.
Right. But, and I think, right. Well, and that connects directly to how Cheryl has clarity in her approach and how, like, I want every city to have a Cheryl because she's able to look at, like, here are the systems that I'm interacting with. Here are the people. Where are going back to the Trojan horse, where are our unknowns in between the system and the people? And how can we reconnect that? And solve and answer that question for those unknowns. I think her framing and use of soft power of being able to give up, like going through that system, listening to the people, bringing that back, allowing for others to be celebrated for getting all of this work done. I think that's one of the reasons that you and I want to celebrate her so much is that she's not, you know, putting herself first and foremost in those spaces. Instead, she is solving the problem, focused on evaluating, focused on learning what those emotional responses, how those physical spaces are utilized. In a Story City sense, I would look at it and say, she learned what the characters were in her city. She learned each of the locations as a character. She learned what those characters are capable of, what they're not.
And how they got repeat visitation.
Right. And how those characters connect to the rest of that community. And so like, how are all of these people on this theatrical playset interacting? And the script that she has written is, I think, what we love about the work that she's done and why we want other cities to have versions of her.
And I think she gently guides people to do, as you say, those economic metrics and the emotional response metrics. And she guides people in how to tell those stories because she recognizes that you need both, right? And I think that maybe one of the things that Austin was finding was that they were potentially leaning too hard into that economic metric. And the, so the creators are feeling like they're missing the other metric, but they want to only have the other metric. Whereas like taking this, this balanced approach of Cheryl, where you treat both and you tell the stories of both, is I think where that balance should lie.
Yeah. And I want to highlight though, that the important theme here is how kind of like in Baltimore, where this season, where we saw that they didn't just put in art there, they recognized that art is an artery in between two different parts of the city. Cheryl also takes a very slow approach to power, right? Of slow iterative placemaking, so that that's what really consensus requires. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think that we live in a world where everybody can like something really quickly or thumbs up something really quickly on Reddit and push a certain opinion to the top. But to truly build consensus, you have to do it the way of Cheryl or the way of Baltimore, right? Or I should actually give West Palm Beach a little bit more credit. You got to do it the way of West Palm Beach and the way of Baltimore. But that is that slow, measured understanding of what you're addressing and how you're building it out.
Yeah, I think you guys can tell. I think you guys can tell that, like, yeah, Cheryl just, she hugely resonates with me. And what
me too.
I always wanted to build, like what I always try to build with Story City, which is that model of test in the real world spaces, build joy into infrastructure, treat digital infrastructure as important as physical infrastructure and cultural infrastructure and economic infrastructure, and letting communities live the story of their city in really tangible and memorable ways.
That's hyper unique to them. Right. I think that that's the caveat there, is that it is something that, like, my community here in the little neighborhood I live in, and even the neighborhood next door, have different wants. And being able to adapt and be, as you're saying, acupuncturist, and say, yep, this is a great solution here, and we need another solution for here, and then connecting the system so that the two solutions can work together, is what Cheryl's done on the back end that I think that we are super impressed with.
So yeah. Friends, next week we close out season two.
So sad.
Yeah. Again, though, it's by building the city of our dreams. So we're taking everything that we've learned for Tulsa, from Vancouver, from Baltimore, from Austin, from West Palm Beach, and we are crafting a vision of what public space can truly be. So join us for this, you know, playful, provocative finale, full of some takeaways, some subtle critiques, and you know, clearly the secret ingredients of vibrant cities that you're not going to want to miss. How did I do about being American about that, Tim?
Great. I would just change it to say, tune in next week for more amazing shit. Yeah, we need amazing shit right now in America, and this is what we're going to do. So tune in next week, some more fun stuff of how to make your cities great, and then vision with us and tell us where we might be wrong or where you would do it differently, and engage in this dialogue the way that Cheryl encouraged people. This is our Trojan horse, this podcast. So give us your thoughts. Let us know. And we're excited to take our learnings and your thoughts and bring them together for our amazing closeout of the season. So with that, as an American, cheers.
The Vibrant Spaces podcast is produced by Story City. You can find our entire archive on any podcasting app and on about.storycity.app, where we publish transcripts and show notes. This episode was produced by Tim Souza, and our staff includes Justin Kahn, Brett Ludwig, and Victoria Unitska. Our theme song is Happy Indie by Alex Guz. Our co-hosts are Tim Souza and me, Emily Craven. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you have a glorious adventure this week.